We're talking about the Bridgewater Triangle and a whole bunch of mysterious stuff that goes on in that 200 square mile part of Massachusetts. The director, Aaron Cadieux, is going to be joined here by paranormal researcher Christopher Pittman, who was a great resource for putting the film together and trying to track down some of these mysteries. Chris Pittman will join us right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Aaron Cadieux, my guest, the director of the film The Bridgewater Triangle, and I are joined now by Christopher Pittman, a multi-year paranormal investigator from southeastern Massachusetts. Chris, great to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We've sort of covered already some of the strange stuff that's happened in the Bridgewater Triangle, giant cats and red-eyed dogs and disappearances, satanic activity. Bigfoot, a whole bunch of strange stuff, but we haven't concentrated on one of the areas that is of particular interest to you, and that's UFOs. How did you get started in looking into the triangle itself? Were you already interested in the UFO topic, or did it work the other way around?
Yes, I had started investigating UFO sightings in 1993, and by 1996, I had come across really quite a number of sightings from the area that is known as the Bridgewater Triangle. It was in about 1996 that I really started to focus on this area, wondering why is it that in this one region, this one part of Massachusetts, which really isn't, it's not as densely settled as other parts of Massachusetts. There's nothing about it that would seem to be really conducive to a lot of UFO sightings, but for whatever reason, there were so many coming from this area. So I started to travel there frequently, talking to UFO witnesses, learning about more and more sightings. And as I was doing that, often people would mention to me, it's really funny, in the same area where I saw this UFO, someone else reported a Bigfoot sighting. Or a witness would say, by the way, I think my house is haunted. Do you know if there's anybody that I could talk to about that? And at first, I kind of disregarded that stuff. I thought at that time that UFOs were maybe aliens from space, and I couldn't see any connection between ghosts or Bigfoot and these flying saucer sightings. But eventually, it became something that I couldn't deny, something that I couldn't ignore anymore. And I started to look into these other kind of more esoteric and for me at that time, very new types of reports. And I came to the conclusion that yes, there's really something unusual happening here, and there's something that connects these things. Somehow, it's all related.
What is it?
Well, I'm not really sure, and there's a lot of theories, but not a lot of facts. There's a lot of speculation, but really nothing in the way of proof. I think for me, the best evidence for the reality of the Bridgewater Triangle as something that's really special is the consistent reports over a period of decades, centuries in some cases, from exactly the same spots. I'm not talking about the same towns or even parts of towns, but the same roads, the same stretches of the same roads, that people who maybe have never heard of the Bridgewater Triangle over and over tell me, I came around this bend and I saw something that I couldn't explain. It's got to be something. There's something out there that these people are having encounters with, and no one knows what it is. We could talk about another dimension or something like that, but ultimately that's just explaining a mystery with another mystery. In the end, after all these years, I still have more questions than answers.
Well, I know what you mean. I mean, I've been down this road sort of myself regarding the Bigelow Ranch, aka Skinwalker Ranch in Utah, which has all this strange stuff, maybe an even greater concentration than the Bridgewater Triangle. It seems as if sometimes that the phenomena itself is trying to tell us it's all related, but what the connection is, I don't know, and it's
Yeah,
frustrating.
it's really elusive. And there's a lot of special things, having looked at the Bridgewater Triangle for so long, there are a lot of things that make it unique. There's the Hockomock Swamp that I know that you already talked about. There is so much water in that swamp. There are so many gallons of water flowing through this massive aquifer. And you've got high tension power lines that are running through the region. Underneath all of that vegetation in the swamp, underneath 40 feet of water and decaying vegetation, there are some really unusual sediments that were laid down by glaciers more than 10,000 years ago. These sediments have a lot of magnetic minerals. Some people think that these sediments maybe could account for problems with compasses malfunctioning, maybe even GPS units refusing to work in some cases. In the end, we really don't know.
I want to ask you, Chris, and then you, Aaron, about a working relationship on the film. There you are, Chris. You're looking into the idea that maybe it's an Indian curse, that the whole area has been cursed for a couple hundred years. That's why we're seeing ghosts and UFOs and Bigfoot and all kinds of stuff. You're working with the director, though, who is pretty much skeptical about all that stuff. I just want to know if it comes to a point where you're trying to tell him a story and he's not believing it and you want to throttle him.
Well, it was never like that. I think that I share in many ways Aaron's overall skeptical outlook, in the sense that I enjoy the stories, I enjoy talking about this stuff, I enjoy the folklore and the legends, but what I really want to know is this stuff real? What of this is real? What of this is factual? And I think that that's something that is running through Aaron's mind all the time as well. So talking to him, working with him, I was really pleased with the comments of mine that he used in the film. I think he really captured my viewpoint about this and my attitude about it. And he asked some great questions in the interviews that we did. It was really pleasant. He was great.
Well, I agree that, you know, when you're dealing with this stuff, you have to be skeptical. It doesn't mean you're a debunker, you don't believe anything, but skepticism is an ally in chasing something like this. Aaron?
Yeah, well, I think there are definitely people who I think are just kind of trying to collect stories without really evaluating them. And that can be fun too, but I'm coming at it from a different angle.
Aaron?
I think one of the most important things that we tried to do with this film was we are not trying to prove the existence of any of these things. We're not trying to convince people that the Bridgewater Triangle has any legitimacy to it or not. We just wanted to present the stories, present the information in an unbiased way, in an unbiased journalistic fashion. And we wanted to let the story speak for themselves, and we wanted people to walk away from the film making their own determination as to the legitimacy of the Bridgewater Triangle as a concept. And, you know, I think we were pretty successful at that. And if you listen to what we wrote, which is essentially everything you hear the off-screen narrator say, we use a lot of language like reportedly, allegedly, as
yes.
The story goes. So we were not trying to cram this down anybody's throat. And basically, we were not trying to insult the intelligence of the viewer.
Yeah, I think you're careful. I noticed that in listening to it. And I think you walked a fine journalistic line there. I want to talk about UFOs for a couple of minutes, Chris. I know it's a special interest of yours, but let's get into it by listening to another clip from the film that talks about a particular incident, I believe.
The spring of 1979 proved to be the most active period of documented UFO sightings in the history of the Bridgewater Triangle region. A number of news outlets and law enforcement agencies were flooded with reports of large, low-flying UFOs. During that time, former WHDH reporters Jerry Lopes and Steve Sprasia claimed to have witnessed what is arguably the most famous UFO sighting to occur within the Bridgewater Triangle.
Jerry Lopes and I work at WHDH Radio, and we were heading down to the Raynham Dog Track, and when we got off 24 onto 106, I noticed this really bright light over the tree line, and the light was coming closer and closer and getting bigger and bigger. And I remember saying to Jerry, "What is that over there?" So we pulled his vehicle over, and all of a sudden the stars blotted out in the shape of an arrow as this thing passed overhead.
Ironically, a big baseball fan, it looked like a baseball home plate, and there were a series of lights on it.
And it was very, very wide. Perhaps the width of now, we'd say 5747s wing to wing.
It looked like it had a little cord or something hanging off it, and sparks were coming off of it. I almost felt like I could throw a rock at the thing. And it just hovered there for a minute. It looked like it was over a little bit of a field. And the next thing you know, it just kind of just took off.
I keep looking up because even to this day, as I look up, I can imagine I can see the darn thing. It made that much of an impression on me.
I saw what I saw. I reported
Chris,
what I saw, and I've moved on.
Chris, talk to me about that in that case. Now, these two guys work for a TV station. I can tell you flat out that it does no good for anybody's credibility or their careers to tell a UFO story, but they came forward. I thought their interviews in the film were very credible and very detailed. that incident sounds pretty good. I mean, a UFO the size of 5 747s, that's not swamp gas.
No, definitely not. As someone who's investigated UFO sightings for a long time, I feel like I can state with something approaching certainty that there is no possible conventional, reasonable, normal, prosaic explanation for what those men described. We're talking about really a kind of a dream case from a UFO investigator standpoint. You've got very credible, intelligent witnesses willing to come forward and put their names on their stories. They're describing something that totally is inexplicable, something totally unusual, and that was my favorite part of the movie. I really enjoyed hearing them tell that story. And of course, there are other UFO sightings like that from the Bridgewater Triangle as well.
Well, share some of those with us, the range of different kinds of craft or objects that have been seen.
Well, it's interesting because looking at it over time, you can see there have been kind of waves or periods of increased levels of activity. As the narrator of the film, John Horrigan, mentioned in the beginning, 1979 was a time of an elevated level of UFO activity. There were a lot of sightings that were kind of daylight sightings, structured craft. Then in the 1990s, you've got another wave. This time it's a little different. Almost all the sightings are at night, mostly lights in the sky, but still some really interesting reports with a lot of details, things that make it easy to rule out something like aircraft or stars or planets. And then more recently, there have been some other reports that have kind of gotten a lot of attention, but these reports are exclusively at night. They're often described as fireballs, they're spheres, yellow, orange light, and I think what's being seen in those cases may be like Chinese lanterns, some kind of balloon, illuminated balloon. So I'm not really sure about those, but certainly looking at the spectrum of reports over time, there are a great many that are really interesting, that are really compelling.
Aaron, tell me the story of the Dighton Rock. I'd never heard of this thing before. I saw the images of it in the film, and it looks pretty intriguing.
Yeah, Dighton Rock is a large trapezoidal-shaped boulder that was found in the Taunton River. It has a large flat face on it, which has these carvings and inscriptions on it, which have puzzled archaeologists for hundreds of years. What has happened over time is the Massachusetts State Authorities have pulled that rock out of the Taunton River and enclosed it in a museum in present-day Berkeley. It's called Dighton Rock, but it's actually in the town of Berkeley. And if you go into this museum, there are a number of different theories that are presented on the walls of the museum that you can read about as to where the inscriptions came from. There's a theory that it was Native Americans carving on the rock. There's a Norse or Viking theory. There's a Phoenician theory. And there's a theory that it was Portuguese explorers in the early 1500s. And the various theories present their evidence, and they will trace some of the markings on the rock to try to sway people to their argument. And then there are other people that say, it's not just one particular culture that was responsible for this. We think it was a billboard. If a Viking ship, hundreds and hundreds of years ago went through the area, they may have carved on a portion of the rock, and then in 1511, Miguel Cortriel and his Portuguese explorers passed by that same rock, and they carved on the rock, and the Native Americans carved on the rock. So there are just a ton of theories as to the origins of Dighton Rock, and the main theories are presented at the museum. But then there are, more fringe theories that, it could have been extraterrestrials and UFOs, and there's even theories that it was Chinese explorers and things like that. So the list is just endless, and it just adds to the overall mystique and lore of the Bridgewater Triangle that there's this boulder that nobody has an explanation as to the origins for.
Yeah, it's like a bathroom wall or something. Everybody comes in and adds a little graffiti to it.
It is, for anybody that lives in the region, I highly recommend making the trip to see Dighton Rock. It's kind of flies underneath the radar as far as attractions in the area, and it's really worth a look, and it would really help the museum if more people would take the time to go check it out.
Chris, I mentioned to Aaron earlier that I thought one of the strongest parts of the film was how he weaves in Native American legends, how the lore of these legends is so important to the story of the Bridgewater Triangle. I found that particularly appropriate when you were talking about the graves, the excavation of these graves where red ochre pops up. Can you tell that part of the story, or should Aaron do that?
Yeah, I can talk about that. This was an excavation that took place at a place called Grassy Island. It was decades ago. The excavation was of some 8,000-year-old graves, and I think it's interesting to note about this region, the general area of the Taunton River drainage that constitutes much of the Bridgewater Triangle, is that this area was perhaps the most densely settled area in the northeastern part of what is now the United States in prehistoric times. You had people there 10,000 years ago and before, and huge numbers of people there for hundreds and hundreds of years, for thousands of years throughout prehistory. But in this particular excavation, the archaeologists, when they opened the graves, they discovered this red ochre pigment that seemed to bubble and dissipate when it was exposed to air. And none of the photographs that were taken of the excavation were successfully developed, which was something that was remarked upon as unusual by the archaeologists. Of course, this was decades ago, and it's possible that they were kind of used to taking pictures that didn't come out. But the part about the red ochre is really interesting, because red ochre is something that was made in ancient times according to a very sophisticated chemical formula. It's actually a number of ingredients mixed together to form this pigment. And certainly the detail about it bubbling and fizzing is something fascinating. In my time investigating the traces on the landscape left by Native Americans, I've found some red ochre pigment, none of it that kind of bubbled when exposed to air, certainly.
You ever spent the night out there in the swamp?
I sure have, and I actually don't recommend it to anybody, because it really is frightening. The Hockomock Swamp is a really dense place, and there's a lot of mosquitoes out there in the summertime, and it's easy to get lost. You can go for walks out there and walk a great distance without ever seeing real dirt or a stone, because what you're standing on is 40 feet of decaying vegetation going back thousands of years. In fact, if you could strip away that layer, you could find the stone tools of people who lived in what is now the swamp 10,000 years ago.
Is it protected? Is the area protected, or can anybody go there?
Anybody can go there. It kind of protects itself. In the summertime, as I said, with the mosquitoes, the black flies, there's animals out there. It's really dense. It's nasty. The foliage forms in places an absolutely impenetrable barrier. If you can imagine just an incredibly dense thicket of reeds and grass that grows 14 feet tall. But in the spring and fall, there are places where you can walk along the power lines, and it can be pleasant. And certainly the people who are out there, mostly hunters or people on ATVs, when I encounter them out there, they almost invariably have some kind of unusual, spooky story of their own.
Aaron, we're going to go to a break when you hear the music in probably about a minute. Tell me this. Have you evaluated the potential consequences of the film? I know that when films and projects have come out, books even, about paranormal hotspots, what happens is the places get run over, that people, amateur investigators and the paranormal enthusiasts, will suddenly flood into a region. Are you thinking about that as a possible consequence of your film?
Yeah, I know it's inevitable, and we always tell people, you know, if you're going to go into these places, make sure you have the proper permissions and the proper, you know, clearances to do so. And, you know, we make sure to clarify that we're not responsible for what, you know, other people do. But one of the sad things that's happened is, even since the film's come out, a lot of people have come forward with stories that would have made for great interviews for the film, and, you know, maybe we can feature them in bonus features on the DVD or whatever, but, you know, we knew that was going to happen as well.
Part two. Could be a part two.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, without a doubt.
I'm talking with Chris Pittman and Aaron Kaju about the Bridgewater Triangle. When we come back, we'll get into some ghost stories, and there are a whole bunch of them in the Bridgewater Triangle. Much more to come here. We're talking with Aaron Kaju and Chris Pittman about the Bridgewater Triangle. When we come back, we're going to jump into some ghost stories. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Aaron, let's talk about ghosts a little bit. I had the impression from what you said at the beginning of our interview that's not a really favorite topic of yours, that you're highly skeptical about ghosts. Were you always going to include ghost stories in the film?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to talk about the Bridgewater Triangle, with the abundance of ghost stories that come out of the region, it's kind of a necessity. I'm not opposed to the theory of ghost related activity in the Bridgewater Triangle. It's just not, like you said, it's not a personal favorite of mine. I'm more drawn to the cryptozoological and true crime aspects of the triangle. But nevertheless, there is some very interesting spiritual activity that has been reported in the area, and we did feature some of that in the film. Now, that's the one topic that, if you were to cover every single ghost story that came out of this 200 square mile region, you'd be talking about a 60-part, 1-hour, series.
There was something that happened during a production that that you highlight in the film, where the lights go out. Tell me of that story. It must heck of a coincidence, huh?
From the perspective of a big time ghost skeptic, that really made the hair on the back of my neck and arms stand up. To make a long story short, we were interviewing Christopher Balzano, who is a researcher and author who's done a lot of work in the Bridgewater Triangle. We were interviewing him out in the middle of the Freetown State Forest, and it was an interview that wasn't really ever supposed to have happened. But after giving us a tour of the forest, he locked his keys in his car, so we were waiting for AAA to come let him into his vehicle. So we had some time to kill, so we quickly just set up a makeshift interview and started asking him a slew of questions related to the Bridgewater Triangle. And at one point, he was talking about this location, which is in Rehoboth, called Anawan Rock, which is actually where the official surrender took place during King Philip's War. Now, at that point in the war, Philip had already been killed by aldermen, and his body had been drawn and quartered. But prior to being captured by the colonials, Philip probably could sense that the end was near, and he passed along a wampum belt to his war chief, Anawan. Now, the wampum belt is said to have told the oral history of the Wampanoag tribe. And so Anawan carried this wampum belt into the official surrender of the Wampanoags at the end of the war at Anawan Rock. He presented it to Captain Benjamin Church as a symbol of his surrender. The whereabouts of that belt are still unknown. Nobody knows what happened to it after it came into the possession of Benjamin Church. There's different theories as to where it is. Some people say that it's actually in a museum sitting in a box in England somewhere. But Christopher Balzano was talking about the wampum belt and its relationship to the Bridgewater Triangle. And he was talking about it in the sense that some people theorize that until the wampum belt is returned to the Wampanoag tribe, the strange occurrences are going to continue in both the Bridgewater Triangle at Anawan Rock and in the Freetown State Forest, which actually has a Wampanoag Indian reservation on it. And as he was talking about the wampum belt, the lights shut off. And it's a point in the film where a lot of people think that there was like a bad edit, or, because the film's pretty tight up to that point in terms of the editing and the flow. And all of a sudden, the whole flow gets kind of disrupted where the lights shut off, and you see us get everything back up and running. And a gentleman off camera, Matt Moniz, says to Chris Balzano, "Do you realize that you were talking about the wampum belt?" And then, boom, the lights went out. And there was this funny reaction from Chris. He swears, and everybody was kind of laughing and chuckling about it. And he jokingly kind of turned as if he's addressing the spirits and said, "Don't worry, we hear your message. If I could, I would return it." And as soon as he said that, bam, the lights went out again with a set of brand new fresh batteries in the portable lights that we were using. And it was just perfect timing. And I just could, I mean, there are people that, investigate the paranormal their whole lives and do these ghost hunts and whatever. And there are people that have never had something like that happen. And it was just a really, really strange occurrence.
Chris, are you a ghost guy? I mean, have you been chasing the ghost? You said earlier it was the UFO stuff that led you to this, but are you into that topic now? And if you could, can you share with us some of the highlights of ghost stories from the Bridgewater Triangle that our listeners might appreciate?
Well, there's a lot to talk about with ghosts there, certainly. And, I mean, you've got one town, for instance, within the triangle called Rehoboth, has an absolutely staggering number of tiny cemeteries. And for almost every one of those little cemeteries, there's some kind of a weird, creepy ghost story about something that people have reported seeing there over the years. The thing about the Bridgewater Triangle is you've kind of got this intersection of documented sightings, of factual claims, and then kind of this swirling maelstrom of legends and folklore where it can be tough to find somebody to say, okay, yes, I saw it. More often it's like, oh, this guy called PP told me that this other guy called Krusty Tim had maybe took a photo of a ghost, you know, 25 years ago. And I think those stories are really interesting, but certainly there are people out there. There are some really intrepid investigators, researchers who are trying to analyze some of these ghost sightings. I think something that's interesting about the Bridgewater Triangle is almost to some extent, it's remarkable that there are so many ghost stories about it, even if they're not necessarily true, because there is something really creepy about it, that area. There's something really unusual about it, and there's something about it that makes people feel like maybe there could be ghosts here. Maybe this place could be haunted.
You got references to at least several recordings of strange sounds, strange voices.
Yeah, there's people who are out there recording this stuff. I think there's a lot of I kind of have a skeptical attitude myself about these EVP recordings.
Right.
Some of them seem really compelling. Others, not so much. I think Aaron could talk more on that.
Yeah, I didn't mean to jump on you there. We feature a couple of EVP recordings in the film, one of which is a loud gunshot sound that occurred in a allegedly haunted house in East Bridgewater during an investigation. And another recording actually occurred in one of the cemeteries in Rehoboth that Chris was just talking about. I'm right there with Chris. I am a major skeptic when it comes to the EVPs. I have a lot of respect for the people that do EVP recordings and are into that kind of thing. But my whole thing with EVPs is just, if a ghost wants to communicate with somebody, you know, why does it have to be always like this cryptic hidden message? Like, you know, they'll ask a ghost a question and then they'll say, oh, did you hear that? It said, I want to kill the children or something like that. Why can't the ghost just say, you know, my name is Joe. I was killed here in an accident 25 years ago and I'm the spirit of that gentleman. Like, it's always like these, like, you know, hard to decipher, you know, almost codes in a way. But we did feature a few EVPs in the film, and the ones that we featured were probably some of the more interesting ones that we were shown.
Is there one ghost story that jumps out at you, Chris, that would illustrate the kind of activity that people have reported over the years in that area?
Well, I think that there's the story of Anawan Rock, where Anawan was captured at the end of King Philip's War. That this is a place where people over the years have reported seeing fires that when they kind of approach it, the fire's gone and there's no trace that there was any fire there. People report smelling fire, smelling smoke when there's no forest fire, there's nothing around there that could make someone smell something like that. And there are people who say that they've seen Native American ghosts there, that they've heard Native American voices, even up to the point where people are able to repeat words that upon review seem to be words in Algonquin Indian language. I think Anawan Rock is a really special place. It's possibly the only place in all of New England where an important event happened during King Philip's War where you can go there today and look at something that looks exactly as it did back then. It's unchanged. It looks the way that it would have looked for the participants in the war. And certainly it's a place rich with history. And I think if ghosts are real, then yeah, that's probably a place where you might experience something like that.
Isn't there some place where it's kind of like a cliff or a ledge or a ridge where a lady in white has been seen?
Sure. The ledge in Freetown State Forest. Freetown Fall River State Forest is a really large forest. It's within the Bridgewater Triangle. And it's a place that has been the site of absolutely countless bizarre encounters by people. Virtually any kind of strange claim that you can imagine has been reported by somebody at some time or another, whether it's cattle mutilations, really weird satanic cult activity, unexplained disappearances, murders, UFO sightings, strange animals, phantoms of all kinds. And one area that really figures very prominently in these legends is an old quarry called the Ledge. And supposedly there's this woman, this lady in white, who is, I guess, the spirit of someone who committed suicide there. And over the years, there have been many suicides there. And other people have reported feeling this inexplicable, inescapable draw to jump when they get to the top of this ledge, to jump to their deaths. There have been UFO sightings from the top of the ledge, too. It's an interesting place.
I want to touch on mutilation. Aaron, you mentioned a couple of mutilation incidences earlier in our interview. You know, I've heard that that explanation about satanic cults being responsible for cattle mutilations all over the world. You know, I've been chasing those stories for a lot of years, and ranchers are told, oh, yeah, it's satanic cults coming out into your fields and carving up cattle. And it never made sense to me. For one thing, nobody's ever been caught. These cults roaming around in rural areas are never seen. There's no tracks. There's no blood, no anything. And this is the first case I've ever heard where you actually have evidence that links a cult to cutting up cows, even though, as you said, it is out of the ordinary for satanic folks to do this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is one of the, you know, I have done a little bit of research into the type of stories that you're talking about with these ranchers and mysterious cattle mutilations. But in this case, you did have an elevated level of you know, a satanic element going on, whether it be directly tied to the cult that was operating in the city of Fall River, or whether it was, you know, young copycat, you know, impressionable teenage youth carrying out some of these things. You know, it's kind of difficult to determine. I mean, the Freetown State Forest is such a vast woodland that it would be very easy to just drive out to one of these locations and do something like that without ever getting caught. And you know, there is, you know, evidence that is featured in the film. You know, someone would you know, lay out a giant stone pentagram, and then they would sacrifice a seagull or a small animal and put it in the center and things like that. Whereas I think in some of these other cases across the country, there is no evidence of any kind of ritualistic aspect to it other than, you know, just a dead animal. Whereas in these cases, you had some of the other elements mixed in.
Chris, do you know of any of the animal mutilation cases that would fit the more classic sort of description from this area, the kinds that are often associated with UFOs in other parts of the country?
Absolutely. There is one case where a number of mutilated calves were found in the forest. Apparently, with a total absence of anything to indicate the kind of ritualistic stuff that Aaron was talking about. Unfortunately, I think that this, because there is absolutely weird cultish activity going on out there, when these mutilated calves were discovered, it was just assumed to be part of the same thing. And there's a police officer who's featured in the film, a former police officer, Alan Alves, who kind of has really come forward as a law official who's experienced this kind of stuff, who's in the area, who's willing to talk about it. It's very unusual. Most officers in the area seem to adopt the policy of hear nothing, see nothing, say nothing. But I think he kind of, I'm not sure if he was really open to other possible explanations for how it was that these calves got out into the forest, how they got mutilated. It's kind of easy to picture someone transporting a seagull out there. To me, it's more difficult to imagine someone transporting a truck full of calves to sacrifice them out there in the forest.
Any other animals other than cattle that have been mutilated and in the classic UFO type sense? I mean, horses, deer, anything like that?
No, nothing like that. And really, it was just this one case that was in the late 1990s that I'm talking about. I find it really intriguing, but the photographs that were taken certainly seem to fit the pattern that we're familiar with from looking at apparently UFO-related cattle mutilations. But like I say, you've got this unimaginably complex situation where you've absolutely got real cults out there. You've got stuff that's being reported that's being associated with cults that almost can't be real people. You know, the cult was out there, and I turned on the light, and everybody disappeared. And it's like, you know, you don't know sometimes whether we're talking about ghosts or what people want to call aliens. It's really baffling.
Or the Puckwudgie. I had never heard of this one before. Chris, I don't know if you want to tackle that one, or Aaron, you want to tell us what the legend of the Puckwudgie is?
Sure. The legend of the Puckwudgie is tied into Wampanoag folklore, and essentially the Puckwudgies are these 2 to 3 foot tall troll-like creatures that are said to roam the forests of the region, and they're, you know, said to resemble basically a shrunken Native American with pale gray skin, enlarged fingers, and enlarged ears, and they are said to possess these magical powers. And if you look into the history of the Wampanoag tribe, the Puckwudgies at one point were considered to just be a mischievous troll that would play play pranks on people and do things that weren't essentially, you know, evil. But as time progressed and as the Wampanoag tribe was Christianized by the settlers, the Pukwudgies developed more of a reputation for being associated with the devil and being murderous. And one of the funny stories that's associated with the Pukwudgies is that they will lure, you know, unsuspecting victims to their deaths. And the ledge, which is that quarry that we were talking about in the middle of the Freetown State Forest, was said to be a place where, you know, the Pukwudgies would lead their victims off the ledge, you know, back in pre-colonial times. But if you research the history of the ledge, it was actually a stone quarry that was dug out, you know, back, you know, in the early 1900s or, you know, in the 1930s, maybe. They were pulling quarry out of that legend. It didn't exist prior to that. So that's one of those instances of urban legend mixing in with the whole overall concept of the Bridgewater Triangle, which is something that you run into quite often. But nevertheless, there are a series of sightings that have been reported of these Pukwudgie creatures. Some of them, you know, you can talk to a researcher like John Brightman down in the Freetown State Forest area, who has come across a lot of eyewitness reports of Pukwudgies, and you know, he gives guided tours down in the Freetown State Forest, and he was featured in the film. And another guy like Chris Balzano, who wrote the book Dark Woods, which is a very very good book about the history of the Freetown State Forest and its connection to the Bridgewater Triangle, and he features a lot of really interesting stories of people having Pukwudgie encounters. You know, and in some cases it seems that these creatures, if they do exist, are drawn to people while they're out walking their dogs for whatever reason. There's a story featured in Dark Woods that bears a striking resemblance to a story that we feature in the film from a gentleman up in Raynham, which is actually not in the Freetown State Forest, but his story is very similar.
You know what I thought, and this is not a harsh criticism, but there was one thing that was missing from the film, and that's Native American voices, Wampanoag voices, any of the indigenous people. I really would like to have heard any of their input about the legends, about the lore and some of these phenomena. I can imagine it would be difficult to get them to go on camera, though.
It is. They're very protective of their history, which, you know, I completely respect and understand. And it was rather difficult to get any kind of participation in this project. And, you know, I'm not bitter about it or anything like that. And I can understand that with the struggles that they've had through the years and the way that they were treated. You know, and we are very careful to present anything that we mention about the Native Americans as being theory and nothing more than theory. You know, we're not trying to trivialize their past or you know, poke fun at their customs and history or anything like that. But you know, I agree. It would have been nice to have more of a representation from the Native American community.
Well, maybe when they see the treatment that you've given the topic, they'll open up. I mean, that's been somewhat true with the Skinwalker stuff. We couldn't get anybody to go on camera, anybody from the tribes, to talk about this stuff. They didn't even want us to mention the term, because of fear that it might invoke some evil spirit or something. And afterward, we've been able to get information from them. So maybe you'll turn it around once they see the film.
Well, you know, we can only hope. You know, I have nothing but, you know, the utmost respect for their history and their customs, and it would be an honor to work with them on something.
Does this tribe still have much of a presence there? I mean, they have a reservation. Do they have businesses?
They have a reservation, which is actually in the Freetown State Forest, and it's a little different from like what people would think of as a Native American reservation, you know, out west where people actually are living in homes and whatnot. It's more or less just an area that's reserved for their ceremonies and their rituals. Right. And unfortunately, they don't have much of a presence here in terms of numbers, because, I mean, you're talking about a war that essentially wiped out an entire population of people that happened 300 years ago. Whereas, you know, the further west you go in the United States, the closer to modern day these events occurred, of course. So, like, you know, the massacre of Wounded Knee.
On that somber note, we need to take a break. I'll be back with Aaron and Chris and take some of your questions about the Bridgewater Triangle after this.